Warning, contents of this episode may include murder, sexual assault, including rape, molestation, and various types of other sexual assault, physical assault, abuse, and possible gore. It is advised that you listen at your own risk. Also, mentions of wishes of suicide. Disclaimer, just because someone may have a mental disorder doesn't mean they'll 100% turn out to be a serial killer. This goes for other factors as well. I'd recommend doing your research before assuming something like that. Hello, everyone. How was your day today? It has been a while, but here we are again. So anyways, today we are going to be talking about the killer clown, John Wayne Gacy. And this is part one, depending on how long it takes to get through the research that I've done. You guys know, if you don't know, I'm gonna tell you now, I compile the research that I do into a Google Docs, and I can easily say this is 17 pages of holy shit. Excuse my language, but that's true. This man is the exact thing you might think of for people having a fear of clowns. But what many don't know is that he is also the reason for the Amber Alert, or Child Abduction Emergency System. This was part of the Illinois Missing Child Recovery Act of 1984. This will be mentioned later. So, yeah. If you still don't know who I am talking about, well, first of all, I said what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, so I don't know where you are, if you don't know who I'm talking about, but it is serial killer and rapist John Wayne Gacy, otherwise known as the Killer Clown. Now, let's get into his early life. just FYI, if you hear any background noise, it's the fan that I have going because it gets hot up in the attic where I'm recording. So anyways, John Wayne Gacy was born March 17th, 1942, to parents John Stanley Gacy, an auto repair mechanic and World War I veteran, and Marion Elaine Robinson, who was a homemaker. He also had two sisters. His grandparents were Polish immigrants. Gacy was close to his mother and his sisters as well. His father was an abusive alcoholic. Gacy often endured physical and verbal abuse from his father, who often compared him to his sisters a lot. Just an FYI, or if there's any future parents out there, don't do this to your kid if you're gonna have more than one. And even if it's just one child, don't compare them to other children. That's not good. His mother tried to shield him from this, but this resulted in further name-calling. Yeah, I'm reading that right. Despite this, he said he still loved his father, but he never felt that his father saw him as good enough in his eyes. His father had even punished him when he was caught with a girl. They were doing things at a very young age. But yeah, let's not get into that. A family friend and contractor had also sexually assaulted him, aka molested him, that same year. He never told his father about this because he feared that his father would blame him for what had happened. School did not go well for Gacy either. He was unable to play with other children due to a heart condition. He experienced blackouts that hospitalized him, and due to this, his grades went down and he missed a ton of school. His mother and sister did not doubt his illness, but his father did, and said that he was doing it for attention. Never say that your child's doing anything for attention. I mean, because you never know if they actually are or are not. He said this so much so that he accused him of faking his illness as Gacy lay in a hospital bed. His friends say that he never hit his father back during altercations that they've seen. At some point in his life, he realized that he was attracted to men, which caused a great deal of turmoil for him. Yes, at the time Gacy was a child, it was not as socially acceptable as it is in 2021 to be LGBTQ+. So that's why I'm glad I don't live in the past. Anyways, if I can scroll, okay. In 1960, he would become involved in politics as an assistant precinct captain for the Democratic Party candidate in his neighborhood. This gained him more criticism from his father, who, strangely enough, bought Gacy a car the year he got involved into politics. His father would take the keys away whenever Gacy didn't do what he was told to do, so Gacy bought a separate set of keys to use when his father took away the first ones. Then his father took the distributor cap off the car. This meant that the car was basically useless from my understanding. So soon after his father replaced it, he left for Las Vegas. There he worked in the ambulance service then at Palm Mortuary, as an attendant. He slept behind the embalming room on a cot. He worked there for about 3 months until he confessed that he had climbed into the coffin of a teenage male one night. I mean, I'm not surprised at this point, because I had just got done with the research. I'm not surprised. Honestly, this is the least horrible thing that he has done. Or, as of right now, will do. He experienced a sense of shock after caressing the body. Weird. After this, his father agreed to let him return home. His father was like, yeah, just come home. You're frickin' weird. Just come home. When he returned home, he started attending Northwestern Business College, even though he didn't graduate high school. He graduated college in 1963. Okay, is it still recording? Okay. Sorry, the scroll thing on my mouse is weird. But he graduated from this college in 1963 and started working at Nunn Bush Shoe Company. He was then transferred to Springfield, Illinois, and worked as a salesman. He was then promoted to manager of his department and got engaged to Marilyn Myers in March of 1964, excuse me. He began to work for the J.C.'s as a key man in April and had what Wikipedia refers to as his second homosexual experience that year. He then got married to Marilyn Myers in September. Marilyn's father bought 3 KFCs in Waterloo, Iowa. In 1965, he was the vice president of the Springfield J.C.'s. He was also named the most outstanding J.C. in the state of Illinois that year. The newlywed couple then moved to Iowa so Gacy could work as a manager at the 3 KFCs his father-in-law bought. It was at this job where he'd make $15,000 a year, plus some of the profit from the restaurants. Plus the profits from the restaurants. This was enough for him to be able to open a club in his basement. The employees could drink and play pool. I miswrote pool and it says they would play poo? I started researching for this a long time ago and I did not notice this till now. The KFCs employed both female and male teenagers, but Gacy only socialized with the male employees. He would often give these employees alcohol before he made sexual advances, claiming them to be jokes or that he did it to test his morals. Yeah, sure. Then his wife at the time had given birth in 1966, again in 67, to a son and daughter. Gacy described his life as his family as perfect. He had finally gotten his father's approval, and his father even apologized for the physical and emotional abuse he had caused for so many years. Apologies don't mean anything when it comes to abuse.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. I have my tablet next to me and Siri spoke because I leaned on it. My bad. But yes, apologies will not make up for abuse, any type of abuse that has been going on for years, or, yeah, apologies don't work. Not for me. He then joined the Waterloo branch of the JCs. At the meetings, he supplied fried chicken and insisted on being called Colonel. They considered him to be ambitious and a braggart. Don't ask me what that means, I don't know why I put it in here. But they held him in high regard due to the fundraising he'd done for them. In 67, he earned the title of Outstanding Vice President of the Waterloo JCs within that same year. Excuse me again. He served on the board of directors and was also heavily involved in multiple adult activities. It was in August of 1967 that Gacy sexually assaulted Donald Voorhees, the 15-year-old son of a fellow JC. Gacy gave the boy alcohol, let him watch a mature movie, and then took advantage of the boy. He did this with other teenagers as well, even forcing one to sleep with his own wife. He made several of the victims believe he was commissioned to do homosexual experiments in the name of scientific research. He gave all of them $50. It was then in March 68 that Voorhees had told his father what Gacy had done to him. Police were informed immediately, and Gacy was arrested and charged with performing oral sodomy on a minor and attempted assault on a 16-year-old Edward Lynch. Gacy denied those charges and took a polygraph test. The results said that Gacy was nervous when he denied his claims. When he denied the claims, yes. He still publicly denied the charges and even claimed that they were politically motivated. He claimed Voorhees Sr. had opposed Gacy's nomination as president of the Iowa JCs. Several JCs thought Gacy's story to be true and even supported him. But he was found guilty on the sodomy charge on May 10th, 1968. On August 30th of that year, Gacy persuaded 18-year-old Russell Schroeder to physically assault Don Voorhees so he wouldn't testify against Gacy. He promised to pay Schroeder $300 for this. In September, Schroeder lured Voorhees to a country park, sprayed him with mace, and beat him. Voorhees did manage to escape and report this to the police, identifying Schroeder as the attacker. Schroeder was arrested the following day, and he initially denied involvement, but later confessed and said that Gacy had hired him to beat up Voorhees. Gacy was then again arrested, and this charge was added. On September 12th, Gacy underwent psychiatric evaluation. At the psychiatric hospital of Iowa, two doctors examined him over a period of 17 days. They diagnosed him with an antisocial personality disorder. This could be sociopathy or psychopathy. They said he would not benefit from therapy or treatment, but they deemed him competent to stand on trial. Wow. On November 17th, 1968, Gacy pled guilty to one count of sodomy, but not guilty to the charges related to the other victims. He said that Voorhees consented to it and that he himself had acted out of curiosity. Even if Voorhees had consented, he is still 15. And from the looks of it, Voorhees did not consent at all. Nonetheless, it would have still been considered rape in a court of law because he is under the age of consent, which varies depending on the place. But yeah, he was convicted of sodomy on December 3rd and was sentenced to 10 years at the Anamosa State Penitentiary. That same day, his wife petitioned for a divorce. She wanted the house, property, alimony, and sole custody of their two children. Good decision. The court ruled in her favor. The divorce was finalized September 18th, 1969. He never saw his first wife or the two kids again. Gacy had rapidly gained the title of model prisoner during his sentence. Within months, he had risen to the position of head cook, as well as joined the inmate chapter of the JCs, which increased its membership from 50 to 650 men in 18 months. He secured an increase in inmates' daily pay in the mess hall and supervised several projects that improved conditions for other inmates in the prison. He even oversaw installation of a miniature golf course in the recreation yard. He was denied parole in June 1969, but scheduled another hearing for May 1970. He even managed to complete 16 high school courses and obtained his diploma in November 1969. It was then on Christmas Day that Gacy's father had died from cirrhosis of the liver. Gacy was denied relief so he could not attend the funeral. On June 18th, 1970, Gacy was given parole with 12 months of probation. This means that he, out of his 10-year sentence, only served 18 months. The condition of his probation was that he relocate to Chicago with his mother and have a 10 p.m. curfew. He had told one of his fellow JCs, Clarence Lane, who was picking him up from prison, that he would never go back to jail. Oh boy, was he so wrong. He had wanted to reestablish himself in Waterloo, but given the terms of his probation, that was not an option. Shortly after arriving in Chicago on June 19th, he was hired as a short order cook in a restaurant. His claim that he would never go back to jail did not hold up, however, because on February 12th, 1971, he was accused and charged for sexually assaulting a teenage boy. He said that Gacy had lured him into his car at the Greyhound bus terminal, which is a place that'll come up later, possibly in the next part of this whole episode. This is where he attempted to rape the boy. The case was dismissed when the boy didn't appear in court. On June 22nd, Gacy was once again arrested and charged, this time for sexual battery, which is unlawful physical contact. And also with reckless conduct. A young man had claimed Gacy had flashed a sheriff's badge and lured him into his car and sexually assaulted the young man. These charges were dropped after the complainant... What? These charges were dropped after the complainant had attempted to blackmail Gacy. What is even worse is the Iowa Board of Parole didn't learn about these charges until October 1st, meaning they couldn't do anything about it since Gacy's parole had ended. All of his previous criminal convictions were sealed. For now, at least. At some later point, Gacy had bought a ranch near Norridge Village in Norwood Park Township. He was considered to be very helpful in the community, plowing snow for free, loaning out tools, hosting parties with 400 people in attendance, some of them being politicians. And this is where he stayed until the last month of 1978, where it is said that he committed the majority of his murders. In August 1971, Gacy had became engaged to Carol Hoff, who had two daughters from a previous relationship she had in high school. Shortly after announcing their engagement, Hoff and her two daughters moved into the house with Gacy. His mother moved out just before their wedding on July 1st, 1972. It was by 1975 that Gacy had made his wife aware that he was, in fact, bisexual. After Mother's Day of that year, Gacy spent most of his nights out of the house, often returning in the early morning hours, saying that he was working late. His wife at the time had noticed that Gacy was bringing teenage boys into their garage very, very early in the morning. Wikipedia does not say times, but I'd say, for lack of better description, 1 to 5 a.m. Or 1 through 5 a.m., because that's what I consider early morning hours. Let me just check the time here. Okay. Just a little bit longer. She also found gay porn, men's wallets, and IDs around the house. When confronted with this, Gacy informed his wife that it was none of her business. It was a very heated argument that she failed, so much so that she failed to balance a checkbook correctly and asked Gacy for a divorce. Gacy agreed, but with mutual consent. Hoff and her daughters continued living there until February 1976. For future reference, this means people were in the house as murders were being committed. And they didn't even know. I mean, we can assume that they didn't know. Or they just thought, hey, those are some really weird screams coming from somewhere inside the house. I wonder what they are. Let's totally not investigate. The divorce was finalized in March under false claims of Gacy's infidelity with women. Well then. In 1971, Gacy established PDM Contractors, a part-time construction business. PDM standing for Painting, Decorating, and Maintenance. Upon the approval of his probation officer, he worked evenings on his contracts while working as a cook by day. At first, Gacy did minor repair work like sign writing, concrete pouring, and redecorating. This later expanded to include interior design, remodeling, installation, assembly, and landscaping. In the middle of 1973, he quit his cooking job to make PDM his full-time priority. He was working 16 hours a day, with how much PDM had expanded by 75. In March 1977, Gacy became the supervisor for PE Systems, which was a firm that remodeled drugstores. Between both of these jobs, Gacy worked on upwards of 4 projects at a time and traveled to other states a lot of the time. PDM's annual revenue had been up to $200,000 by 78. Many of PDM's employees were either high schoolers or young men. Gacy would often suggest sex or sexual favors from his workers, and in return he would offer to lend them his vehicle, a promotion, or financial assistance. Piece of advice: if your boss or anyone you work with does this to you, I would suggest either getting HR involved or finding a different job. He also had said to one employee, "Do you know how easy it would be to get one of my guns and kill you? And how easy it would be to get rid of the body?" In 73, Gacy and one of the teenage employees traveled to Florida to view a property, and on the first night there, Gacy raped him in the hotel room they were staying in. Upon returning to Chicago, this employee took matters into his own hands by driving to Gacy's house and beating him in his front yard. He deserved it. Gacy had explained to his wife at the time that the reason for his attack was because he wouldn't pay the employee for the poor quality paint job that he'd done. In May 1975, Anthony Antonucci, who was 15 at the time, had been hired by Gacy. In July of that same year, the two drank a bottle of wine together and watched a hetero adult film. Gacy then proceeded to wrestle Antonucci to the ground and cuff his hands behind his back. But luckily for Antonucci, one of the cuffs was loose. So he freed that arm while Gacy was left temporarily. And when he returned, Antonucci, being the high school wrestler that he was, punched and wrestled Gacy to the floor. It was by doing this that he was able to get the key to the handcuffs, freeing his other arm and putting the cuffs on Gacy, with his hands behind his back. At first, Gacy threatened Antonucci, but eventually calmed down, saying that he would leave if the cuffs were taken off. He stated, "Not only are you the only one to get out of the cuffs, you got them on me." It was the next year in July when Gacy picked up a hitchhiker by the name of David Cram. Now, David Cram will come up later in the story. He was 18 at the time and traveling on Elston Avenue. Gacy offered Cram a job with PDM, which he accepted and began working that very night. On August 21st, Cram moved in with Gacy. Sorry, I got a little bit distracted. The next day, the two celebrated Cram's 19th birthday with drinks. Gacy dressing as Pogo, and eventually... Did I skip over that? Yeah, he regularly dressed as... Oh, it's coming up in the... Yeah. Dressing as Pogo and eventually tricking Cram into wearing handcuffs, this time in front of his body rather than behind him. Gacy then swung Cram around while holding on to the chain link of the cuffs. Gacy had admitted that he intended to rape him, but didn't get to because Cram was able to kick him in the face and get the cuffs off. A month later, Gacy appeared in the doorway of Cram's bedroom, intending to try and rape him again, and said, "Dave, you really don't know who I am. Maybe it would be good if you give me what I want." Cram was able to fend him off, and ended up straddling Gacy, saying, "You ain't no fun." He moved out October 5th, and even though he did quit working officially for PDM, he still did work for Gacy from time to time for the next 2 years. After Cram moved out, another 18-year-old PDM employee, Michael Rossi, who will also be mentioned again later, moved in. He lived with Gacy until April 1977, working for PDM since May of 1976, and even helped Gacy out with the clown gigs. Gacy would dress up as Pogo, where Rossi took on the role of Patches. Patches and Pogo were both clowns that Gacy portrayed. And I thought I put that in there, but apparently not. So I'm gonna say it now. Now, this is the part of the story where his clown persona comes in. It was through his membership of the local Moose Club, a fraternal and service organization in Moose Heart, Illinois, that he found out about the Jolly Jokers Club. Okay, so this is where I put it in. Okay. The members would usually perform at fundraising events, parades. I almost said parades. Yeah. And entertain hospitalized children. Gacy joined this club in 75, and thus Pogo the Clown and Patches the Clown were born. He used his own makeup and costumes. Pogo he described as a happy clown, and Patches was a bit more serious. He didn't earn money from these gigs. He later said it allowed him to regress into childhood. He would perform as both of these clowns at many charity events, parties, political functions, and children's hospitals. He would sometimes stay in these costumes to grab a quick drink at the bar before heading home. It was these clown characters, alongside the murders he committed, that earned him the name Killer Clown. Along with PDM and the clowns, Gacy was also part of the local Democratic Party politics. He offered the use of his employees to clean the party's HQ headquarters free of charge. He was rewarded for his community service of Norwood Park Township Street Lighting Committee, which earned him the title of Precinct Captain. In 75, Gacy was appointed director of Chicago's Polish Constitution Day Parade, which he supervised from 75 until his arrest in 78. It was through this that he was able to meet and get a picture with First Lady Rosalynn Carter on May 6, 1978. This was later deemed to be an embarrassment for the U.S. Secret Service. My sincerest apologies, my foot bumped something. But we are back now. So we left off, let's just recap here. We left off where he was Chicago's Polish Constitution Day Parade. He supervised that from 75 to 78, met Rosalynn Carter, and that was later deemed to be an embarrassment for the U.S. Secret Service, being that he was given clearance because he was wearing an S-pin. Now let's move on to something you probably know more about Gacy, which is the murders he committed, partly for the reason for the warning prior to the beginning of this episode. For a period of years in the 70s until 78, that is Gacy. What? For a period of years in the 70s until 78, Gacy was able to murder 33 young men and boys, 26 of them being buried under his crawlspace. No, I can later confirm that to be 29. There was 29 buried in his crawlspace and then several others in other various parts of his property. Now, these victims were usually alone, and Gacy lured them to his house, but recalled that sometimes he was able to get two victims in the same night. He lured them with offers of a job at PDM, drinks, drugs, or money in exchange for sex. This included people he knew, or they were just some stranger he managed to lure from the bus station, or off the streets. The victims were either grabbed by force or, believing Gacy was a cop, given that he often donned a sheriff's badge and had spotlights on his car when he got them in his house. He usually gave the victims drinks, drugs, or made them trust him. That's when he would bring out a pair of handcuffs to show off a little magic trick. He would first cuff his own hands behind his back and then release himself from the cuffs because, duh, he had the key. Then he would put them on the victims, but they were often unable to free themselves. Gacy later stated that the trick was that you had to have the key. He would also restrain the victims' legs by cuffing them to a 2x4 on each end, which was inspired by the Houston mass murders. He would then proceed to rape and torture his victims. This often included forms of sexual assault. The acts of torture would be that of burning the victims with cigars, made them pretend to be a horse as he sat on their backs, and pulled the reins around their neck, among other things. He would sodomize his victims with multiple foreign objects, one example being prescription bottles, and if you do not know what sodomize means at this point, he stuck foreign objects in their rectal area. Yeah. He put things in their butt. He would also verbally taunt his victims throughout all of this. He would drag them around, make them crawl into his bathroom. This is where he would repeatedly drown and revive his victims. Then he would place a rope around their neck and continuously tighten it with a hammer handle. He would read a part of Psalm 23 while doing this. The victims would convulse, that is, where their muscles and body contract and relax rapidly. This often results in uncontrollable shaking for 1 or 2 hours, and then they died. All except for his last two victims, who died of asphyxiation, that being from cloths or gags that were shoved down their throats. He would put the bodies under his bed for up to 24 hours, then bury them in his crawl space or other parts of his house. Some of the victims were embalmed in Gacy's garage prior to being buried. Now, let's talk more about some of the victims. Hold on, I need to autocorrect this. There we go. The first known murder victim is a 16-year-old boy named Timothy McCoy. It was January 3rd, 1972, per Gacy's account. The night before, Gacy had decided to drive to the Civic Center in the Loop, which is one of Chicago's 77 designated community areas, to view ice sculptures the following morning. That day he lured McCoy from the Greyhound bus terminal into his car. McCoy was traveling to Omaha, Nebraska from Michigan. Gacy took McCoy on a tour of Chicago, then Gacy took him to his own house to have McCoy spend the night. He then drove him back to the terminal the next day, and then the plan was to have him stay overnight and then drive him back to the terminal the next day. Prior to McCoy being identified, he was simply called the Greyhound busboy. See, I told you the Greyhound bus terminal would make an appearance again. Gacy woke up early to see that McCoy was in his bedroom doorway with a kitchen knife in his hand. He then got out of bed and went for McCoy, who raised his arms in surrender, cutting Gacy's arm accidentally. Gacy was able to twist the knife out of McCoy's hand, bang his head on the bedroom wall, kick him against the wardrobe in his room, and then walk towards McCoy. McCoy then kicked Gacy in the stomach, doubling him over, but Gacy caught him before he could run away and said, "Mother effer, I'll kill you." He then wrestled McCoy to the ground and repeatedly stabbed him in the chest. Gacy then says he washed the knife, went to the kitchen where he saw an unopened carton of eggs, slab of bacon, and a table set for two. Let it sink in that he was merely making breakfast for the both of them and ended up being murdered. Has it sunk in yet? Okay. McCoy had gone to Gacy's room, absentmindedly bringing the knife with him. To wake Gacy up, Gacy buried McCoy's body in the crawl space where many other victims would be buried. Gacy put concrete over McCoy's grave. Gacy said that he felt totally drained, but he also noted that he was turned on by the sound of McCoy choking on his own blood. Gacy's next murder victim, as of what we know, unprofessional. Let me just turn this thing off. Okay. Gacy's next murder victim, as of what we know, has yet to be identified, but was murdered sometime between January 1974. The victim was strangled and placed in Gacy's closet before being buried. He noted the bodily fluids that leaked from his victims would stain the carpet, so that is why he stuffed cloths into the victim's own underwear or a sock in the mouths of the victims to prevent the leakage from happening. His third victim, John Butkovic, was 18 years old at the time. He was one of Gacy's young employees, disappeared on July 31st, 1975. The day before his disappearance, Butkovic had confronted Gacy about his 2 weeks worth of outstanding back pay. Upon his disappearance, the boy's father, Yugoslav, an immigrant, had called Gacy to possibly ask for his help in searching for his son, his now missing son. Gacy said to the boy's father that he was happy to help in the search, but was sorry that the boy had run away. When questioned initially about the missing boy, Gacy said two of his friends had arrived and were demanding pay that was overdue. They'd reached a compromise and all three of them left. Butkovic's parents called the police over 100 times in a period of 3 years, urging them to investigate Gacy further. Gacy later admitted that he had encountered the boy exiting his car at the corner of West Lawrence Avenue, waved to get his attention, and the boy approached his car because he wanted to talk with Gacy. Butkovic was invited back to Gacy's home to settle the issue of the outstanding pays, but for Butkovic, it was there that Gacy offered him a drink and then got the cuffs on him by conning him with that trick we mentioned earlier, no doubt. Gacy later confessed that he sat on the boy's chest for chest before strangling him. Butkovic's body was stored in his garage with full intent to later bury it in the crawl space. When his then wife and children had returned home earlier than expected, he buried Butkovic under the concrete in his garage, where he'd intended to put a drain tile. It was between 1975 and 78 that Gacy had what would be called his cruising years. He would cruise around the area picking up young men. Officers that observed his house around 1975 often saw young men going in and out of the house. Many of them were stopped for questioning, but none of them said anything against Gacy. Gacy remained gregarious, but neighbors noticed an erratic change after his divorce in 76. They too also reported seeing many young men in his company, as well as the sounds of his car driving in or out of the driveway in the early morning hours. It was at this time that they sometimes saw lights in Gacy's home turn on and off. One of his neighbors later recalled that they would hear muffled, high-pitched screams, shouts, and cries, and said that those woke her son up very early in the morning, and that this occurred for several years. "You could have at least made a noise complaint, ma'am." Like, She had she said those noises were coming from a house near theirs on Summerdale Avenue. Okay, so she didn't know exactly what house. My bad. January 1976, officers staked out Gacy's house as he was suspected to be involved in the disappearance of a 9-year-old boy. This was done by Chicago Police Youth Division. They were not able to build a case against Gacy. In 1976, after 1 month of Gacy's divorce being finalized, 18-year-old Daryl Sampson went missing. He was last seen in Chicago on April 6th. His body was buried under Gacy's dining room with a cloth lodged in his throat. 5 weeks later, on May 14th, Randall Reffitt, who was 15 at the time, went missing while he was on his way home from Shawn High School. Just hours after Gacy abducted Reffitt, he also abducted 14-year-old Samuel Stapleton, who was walking home from his sister's apartment. It is believed that they were murdered in the same evening and buried together in the crawl space, Reffitt and Stapleton. June 3rd, a 17-year-old Michael Bonin was killed by Gacy. He was traveling from Chicago to Waukegan. He was strangled with a cord or rope, and then his body was buried under the spare bedroom. William Carroll, a 16-year-old, was murdered 10 days later. His body was also put in the crawl space. He was the first of four to be murdered between June 13th and August 6th. The other three were unidentified, between the ages of 16 and 17. Another unidentified victim appears to be an adult. Here are the list of the rest of the victims that were murdered in 1976. August 5th, James Byron Hackinson, known as victim number 24 until 2017. He was 16 years old from Minnesota. Last heard by his family using a phone in Gacy's home. Died of suffocation, buried in the crawl space. Sadly, his mother never got to learn what actually happened to her son as she died in the early 2000s. Rick Johnston, 17, last seen alive on August 6th, buried in the crawl space above Hackinson. Unidentified, killed sometime between August and October. Unidentified, killed between August or October. Kenneth Parker, October 24th, last seen outside a restaurant on Clark Street. Michael Marino, October 24th, friend of Kenneth Parker, last seen outside a restaurant on Clark Street. 7. William Bundy. William Bundy, 19, construction worker, disappeared after telling his family he was on his way to a party. Death, suffocation, body buried under Gacy's master bedroom, had worked for Gacy. December, PDM employee Gregory Godzik, 17, last seen by his girlfriend outside of her house after dropping her off after a date. Worked at PDM for 3 weeks before he went missing. Told his family he had dug trenches for possible drain tiles. His car was found in the Niles. His parents contacted Gacy about the disappearance. Gacy said he had simply run away and had indicated that he wanted to do so. He also said that he had a voicemail from Godzik, but when asked if it could be played back, Gacy said that he had erased it. Now here is the list of murders and other things that happened in 77. January 20th, John Sizek, 19, was lured by Gacy to his house under the premise that he was possibly buying a satellite dish from him. Sizek was strangled to death in his spare bedroom. Rossi had been asleep at the time. Rossi was later sold John Sizek's car by Gacy for $300. March 27-year-old Jeff Rignall accused Gacy of luring him into his car with marijuana. Gacy then used chloroform to make Rignall unconscious, drove him to Gacy's house, handcuffed him, and sexually assaulted him. Gacy let him go. Rignall sued him for $3,000. Gacy was also charged with battery. Rignall then goes on to write 29 below about his experience. December 31st, Gacy was arrested after a 19-year-old said Gacy had kidnapped him at gunpoint and sexually assaulted him. Gacy confessed to this, but he said the boy participated willingly. The decision not to prosecute him was made by an assistant state's attorney. December 1976 to March 1977, unidentified adult male, buried in the crawl space. John Prestige, 20, went missing on March 15th. He had mentioned before he disappeared that he had gained work with a local contractor, buried in the crawl space above the victim mentioned before. Spring or summer of 77, unidentified, buried in the crawl space. July 5th, Matthew Bowman, 19, last seen by his mother at a suburban train station. Rossi was arrested for stealing gas while driving Sizek's car. A station attendant noticed the license plate number, which was traced back to Gacy's house by police. He said Sizek sold him the car in February and needed the money to leave town. The car's vehicle identification number had confirmed this. Robert Gilroy, 18, son of Chicago's police sergeant, last seen alive on September 15th, lived four blocks away from Gacy, buried in the crawl space. September 12th, Gacy flies to Pittsburgh for a remodeling project, returned on September 16th. This provided support to Gacy's claim that he had accomplices and assistants in several of the murders. John Mowry, 19, former U.S. Marine, last seen walking to his apartment from his mother's house, was strangled and buried beneath the master bedroom. October 17th, Russell Nelson, 21, last seen outside of a bar in Chicago, was looking for contracting work. Body was buried underneath the guest bedroom. 4 weeks later, Robert Winch, from Calamoose, 16, buried in the crawl space. November 18th, Tommy Bowling, 20, father to one child, disappeared after leaving a Chicago bar. December 9th, David Talsma, 19, U.S. Marine, went missing after telling his mother he would be going to a rock concert in Hammond, was strangled with a ligature, buried in the crawl space. December 30th, Robert Donnelly, 19, was abducted by Gacy at a bus stop at gunpoint, driven to Gacy's home where he was raped, tortured, and had his head dunked into Gacy's bathtub repeatedly until he passed out. Gacy confessed to having a slave sex relationship with Donnelly. But said it was consensual and that he didn't pay him what he had promised. Donnelly wasn't murdered. After several hours, Gacy drove him to his workplace and let him go, telling him not to go to the police because they wouldn't believe him. Donnelly was able to testify at Gacy's trial, where he had said that he had told Gacy to kill him, and Gacy replied, saying he was getting around to it. Donnelly did report what Gacy had done to him. 1978. Oh, scrolled up a little bit too far. January 6th, Gacy was questioned on the rape and torture of Donnelly. This is when he confessed to the type of relationship they unconsensually had. Of course, as we mentioned before, he said it was consensual. No charges were filed. A month later, William Kindred, 19, went missing February 16th, told his fiance, who knew Gacy, that he was going to the bar. This was the last victim buried in the crawl space. March 21st, Jeffrey Rignall, 26, lured to Gacy's car, was chloroformed and driven to Gacy's house. Arms and head were restrained with a pillory, a device made of either wood or metal that is used for punishment, public humiliation, and other physical abuse. This was attached to the ceiling. Rignall's feet were restrained by a different device. Gacy explained to him that he now had control over Rignall, and that he could do whatever he wanted with him. Rignall was then raped and tortured with things such as lit candles and whips. This was done repeatedly. He was chloroformed repeatedly to become unconscious. Gacy drove an unconscious Rignall to Lincoln Park and dumped him there. Rignall made his way to his girlfriend's place and informed the police of what happened. The police, however, did not investigate beyond that. Rignall was able to recall a few details, like the Oldsmobile, Kennedy Expressway, and some side streets. May 6th, Gacy met First Lady Rosalynn Carter. On the expressway, Rignall and two of his friends staked out one of the exits. They saw the Oldsmobile, and they followed it to Gacy's address. Police were able to obtain a search warrant, and Gacy was arrested on July 15th. He faced trial for battery committed against Rignall. Gacy confessed to keeping bodies, initially confessing to keeping them in his attic. He was worried about complications of leakage, said he disposed of the bodies on I-55, throwing them into the Des Plaines River. He said he threw about 5 bodies in the river that year. One landing on a barge, flat-bottomed boat, only 4 of these bodies were found. Timothy O'Rourke, 20, first victim known to have his body thrown off I-55 by Gacy. Murdered in mid-June, was leaving his apartment to buy cigarettes. He told his roommate before his disappearance that a contractor, possibly Gacy, had offered him a job. November 4th, Frank Landingen, 19, found in the Des Plaines River in Chanahan on the 12th. November 24th, James Mazzara, 20, disappeared after having Thanksgiving dinner with his family. Before he went missing, he told his sister that he had begun working in the construction business and said he was doing all right. Was last seen alive, walking toward Bughouse Square with a suitcase. December 11th, Robert Peast, 15. He was picked up by his mother after getting done with his shift at Nissan Pharmacy in Des Plaines. He told his mother he wanted to see someone about a contracting job and wanted her to wait for a few minutes. His mother waited a long while, then drove back home in alarm. Came back to the area with her husband, son, daughter, and their 2 German shepherds to look for Peast. The search came up with nothing. It was around 11:29 p.m. that a missing persons report was filed for Robert Peast. Around 10 p.m. that night, Peast was murdered. He had been driven to Gacy's house and said he was willing to work hard for the right price. He told Peast that good money could be earned by hustling. Gacy was able to get handcuffs on him, exclaimed that he was going to rape Peast, and that there was nothing he could do about it. He also said he had placed a rope around the 15-year-old's neck. As one could say, Peast was crying and scared, and Gacy even said as much later on. Gacy had received a phone call from a work friend as Peast lay dying in his house on the floor of his bedroom. December 12th, Lieutenant Cousin Zack, whose son was a schoolmate of Peast, was the one who insisted on a more in-depth investigation, understandable being how close it to home it was for him. Who wouldn't want further investigation, though? During investigation, he learned that Gacy's company, PDM, had recently remodeled Nissan Pharmacy, and figured that whoever Peast had wanted to speak with about the job he was offered. Before this, they had figured that Gacy was the one who he wanted to speak with about a contracting job. Before this, they had done a background check on Gacy and found out about his outstanding battery charge and his previous prison sentence for sodomizing a 15-year-old boy. Cousin Zach and 2 other officers went to Gacy's house to ask him a few questions. Gacy had told him that he did indeed go to Nissan Pharmacy. There he saw 2 young people, asked one of them if there were any remodeling materials behind the pharmacy, the person being Peast. He had He had adamantly said that he never offered Peace a job, but that he did return to the store around 8 p.m. to retrieve the appointment book he left there. Gacy had promised to come to the station later that night, but he never showed up. Police later learned that after the phone call they had with Gacy asked if they still needed him to come in for questioning, that he had moved Peace's body from his attic, put it in the trunk of his car, and threw him over into the Des Plaines River. The reason Gacy indicated that he couldn't be at the station later is because his uncle had just died. When he asked when he would be able to come in, Gacy called the cops rude and asked if they had any respect for the dead. Which seems ironic that he, of all people, would be worried about respecting the dead. At around 3:20 a.m., Gacy did arrive at the police station, but he was covered in mud. His explanation for this is that he had just gotten in a car accident, which was confirmed because he had his car towed from a snowbank at 2 a.m., 38 miles from where he dumped Peace's body. Later, when he came back to the station, he again denied any involvement with Peace's disappearance, and again claimed that he did not offer him a job at all. He prepared a written statement of all of his movements on December 11th, 1978. This was done at the request of detectives. All right, that was part one of the killer clown John Wayne Gacy serial killers series for the John Wayne Gacy episode. My voice is a little tired right now, and I'm gonna have to say after part two, it might be a little while before more episodes come out, because I will be going away to school to get an education. So, yeah. But anyways, I hope you all have a great day, a great life, a great whatever. Stay safe out there. Wear a mask if you're unvaccinated. And I'll see you next time. Bye! Yeah.